Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. This is Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour, and today is Wednesday, August 24th, 2022. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that webpage and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of the book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work, along with an explanation of it. And that tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for a little over 18 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click the link, download it, print it off, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over again, absolutely free. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you choose to tap on that, it will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We hope people do that soon and often because it frequently improves the quality of their lives. It also tends to prompt comments, questions, answers, and testimonials. And if you have any of those to share with us, please give us a call at 563-999-3581. When you do that, if you have a comment to share, just press 1 on your phone, and that will put a little icon of a hand by your phone number, and I'll turn on your microphone and announce you by your area code. I should remind you that you should also, when you click on that link and go to that webpage, the Start Here link, it will take you to a page where you can also access a whole host of audio files that shows just like this one. And if you choose to listen to them, they can serve as a tutorial for how to step through the worksheet program or process, because several people have called in over the years and been stepped through a worksheet live on the air, and those are recorded. And if you don't have access to your own support group, or if you're not willing or able to call in during the show and get your own live support, those audio files can serve as a tutorial to bring you up to speed and help you build mastery with the use of the tools. So I should mention that I had somebody bring to my attention that I was a little bit behind the game when it comes to uploading the simple audio files, the older audio files of me reading, just reading as close to verbatim as I could manage, the Way of Mastery lessons. And so in between sessions throughout the day yesterday, I worked to upload the next 12 lessons. So now 1 through 24 are uploaded on the MindShiftersAcademy.org website on the page titled WOM for Way of Mastery, Audio Recordings of Lessons. And it was interesting because we spent, I think, 3 days, not quite an hour because of the intro and other comments, but three radio show sessions just reading lesson 19 with commentary. And now we're going back and doing it again. But the actual reading, the rather deliberate reading that was recorded, only takes just under 40 minutes to read straight through. So that will give you some idea of how carefully we are trying to go through and identify different aspects and tools to be in the process of slowly considering what's being offered. And for those of us that are so inclined, actually participating in the exercises as they're suggested. It is fascinating to me how diligently we can argue for our own limitations and how stuck we can be in the conditioning and or, you know, brainwashing, some would call it, that has given us our language and our indoctrination into our culture and our families. And I'm pretty sure that Way of Mastery has said this quite clearly, that no one is immune to this. No one comes into the physical body primed with the knowledge of language and culture and spiritual wisdom. We all begin at the beginning. And at one point in one of these lessons, I think it was 15 or 16, it let us know that the reason we seem to be starting from scratch is because it was a shock to our consciousness to move from the realm of the non-physical into the realm of the physical. And we've all had that shock. We've all had that, what they call the forgetting of our true nature, of our essence as consciousness and soul. And as we're reminded, one might say reminded, as we are taught language and we are taught what our individual families and cultures hold as different values, we're basically programmed to value certain things, to focus on certain other things, to have comfort with the knowing versus the comfort or discomfort of the not knowing. And one of the bigger pushes in the last few lessons with the Way of Mastery has been encouraging us, strongly inviting us to recognize that in truth, we don't really know what anything is or is for. And we've been erroneously conditioned in our culture to believe that we know or that we can know and that we should know and that we should have an answer and it should be a quick pat answer and it should be something that fits neatly in a paragraph or a word or a phrase or a book. And the Way of Mastery is offering to us the idea that we are a spark of the divine mind, which is an infinitely expanding creative force. And because it's infinitely expanding, we can't possibly ever be done knowing it or ourselves. And so stepping into that recognition from the space of our training or acculturation or indoctrination leaves us quite solidly in the space of being uncomfortable. And so our job at the first level is to learn to step into what is uncomfortable, to learn to tolerate what's uncomfortable. One of the people in the support group last night was really struggling with a lot of negative emotions and tensions and negative energies. And the thought process that she was stuck in was, but wait a minute, these horrible things, these crappy things really are happening. And then I would breathe and soften and suggest that they recognize that when you say something is a crappy thing, you are just in that moment moving into judgment. You are moving into labeling and contraction. And what this work would call us to in that very moment is to soften and breathe and turn the focus inside and recognize right now in this moment, I'm creating the tension that I'm feeling. Right now in this moment, as I label this a crappy thing, a bad thing, a wrong thing, a horrible thing, a catastrophic thing, I pull myself out of the direct experience of being part of the flow of life and creation, and I pull myself aside from it, and I judge myself as separate from it, and I judge it as bad or wrong. And in that moment, I feel miserable. It was clear that the person in the group last night on the video was very uncomfortable. Difficulty breathing, tears, red-faced, intense changes of vocal tone. And yet, as we were just talking about the lessons from the ancient Aramaic and the lessons from the Way of Mastery and all of these higher spiritual traditions, including people like Byron Katie, who have recognized that she only suffers when she believes her negative thoughts. And we bring that to this person's awareness and say, let's just, without debating whether you're right or wrong about whether or not this thing that's happening in the world right now is crappy or a catastrophe, let's just take a step back and notice how you feel when you reach that conclusion and pour your mind energy into it. What's happening in your body right now? And the person didn't want anything to do with that, because in that moment, the person was arguing for their right to know that they were right and the world is wrong, and that what is unfolding in the world right now is bad and wrong and horrible. And so there's nothing for us to do in an effort to try and support that person except to breathe and soften and gently try to remind them of their true nature as a miracle of the creative energy expressing in form. And when I brought that to this person's attention, she said, I can't buy into that. I can't experience that. I can't feel that about myself. And that has to be okay. We, as fellow travelers, as fellow beings of brilliance and light, need to be okay when people around us are upset like that. And if we decide, you know what, I have to find the perfect thing to say. I have to give that person a box of Kleenex and tell them to dry up their tears and think about light and love. And I have to keep using my mind energy to change their choice in the moment to argue for their limitations. It's really useful in this work to question, why am I doing that? What is going on in me that brings me this urge to try and comfort or change or heal or fix somebody else? And as we look at that over and over again, what we're going to find is we're uncomfortable being with someone else when they are suffering or when they're angry or when they're uncomfortable. So it's literally a selfish move. It's about, I don't want to feel the discomfort that I'm feeling when I sit, stand, or hear your voice when you're being uncomfortable. When I'm near you or I hear your voice or I want a video with you, I don't want to put up with that response in me. And that's why I'm racing around trying to figure out how to fix or change you. Rather than breathe and soften and recognize that I'm making my choice for how to exist in this moment and where to direct my mind energy and which emotions I will choose to create by the thought processes that I'm going to pour my mind energy into, and you and you and you and you and all the rest of these beings of brilliance and light that are on the journey with me, we are all free to choose our own focus of our conscious awareness in each new present moment and thereby create our experience of life. So part of this pathway is the recognition that if I am feeling driven to fix or change or heal other people, it's most useful for me to understand what's underlying that urge or pressure or obsession or passion within me. Within me. And most often I will discover a discomfort, a dissatisfaction, a hurt, a pain, a fear, a sadness in me that's driving me to try to say or do the perfect thing to change the choice of someone else. So we're in lesson 19, and we're going to move ahead a little bit here. We're going to continue. We left off last night or yesterday with the thought at the end of a section, just two pages into lesson 19. The next section reads, "The source of all illusion." Illusions can seem to take many forms, yet they all have one source. That source is a decision to perceive oneself as separate from God. Your, mine, everybody else's decision to try to perceive themselves as separate from God is the source of all illusions. The text goes on and says, the best way to do this, creating the illusion of being separate from God, is to convince yourself that because you're separate from God, there must be many things about you in your life that are out of alignment with the will of the Creator. Therefore, you will manifest many variations that seem to express the instability that is the effect of the one belief, the one perception that, quote, I am separate from my Creator. I have accomplished the impossible, and I will work to keep it in place. Close quotes. Illusions, then, while the form of them may seem to be many, are really just this one thing. And healing occurs when, in the depth of the mind, the decision is made to surrender and to give up the insane idea that one could possibly exist apart from the mind of the Creator. Surrender means to settle into the position of the servant, the conduit through which the mind of the Creator, the love of the Creator, can be expressed. I was in a discussion group over the weekend with some people who had some really strong negative associations and reactions to the word servant. And this is a group that's going back through the book, The Way of the Servant, which was the original book, or Yeshua letters, rather. And in the Yeshua letters, one of the statements it makes is that we are here as a servant of the light that many people mistakenly call God. And so the word servant came into the discussion, and people had lots of comments about how I'm not a slave to anybody, and if I say I'm a servant, what does that mean, that I'm subject to this and that? So right here, they did a beautiful job in the text of moving from the word servant right into the word conduit. I serve not as some kind of a slave, but I am choosing to aid the flow and extension of the creative force, of the love of creation. I'm choosing to make myself open and allow the movement of the creative energy which gave rise to me and keeps my heart beating and my food digesting. I'm going to allow it to flow through me in the most open, free, flowing way possible. So surrender means to settle into the position of the servant, or to be the conduit through which the mind of creation, the love of creation, can be expressed. The mind that exists in perfect surrender sees absolutely no purpose to any moment or experience except this, to extend the good, the holy, and the beautiful, to be that open conduit. And again, in the Western world, a lot of people do not want to hear about the word surrender. Michael Rice has talked about this in his original lectures quite thoroughly. What they don't realize is that they're always surrendering to one thing or another. And in the Western world, most of us are frequently surrendering to upset, anger, fear, sadness, hurt, that tension and resistance. And that's what drives our responses. And in this work, the invitation is to surrender to the energy of creation, to surrender to the flow of life, to surrender to be taught by some infinitely more powerful and integrated mind or consciousness than what my conscious logical mind and all of the trivialities of life that have been programmed into it can offer. So the mind exists in perfect surrender, or the mind that exists in perfect surrender, sees no purpose whatsoever except to extend the flow of creative energy, the flow of life and love, to extend the good, the holy, and the beautiful, is another way to say it. The mind in perfect surrender looks out upon the world that's been healed from its own misperception. I look out, and instead of seeing all of these crappy things in the world, I see far more good in the world, and I see all of the stuff that I used to label as crappy as the extension of the good, the holy, and the beautiful bouncing off of people who have either temporarily forgotten or have yet to discover their brilliance. They've forgotten that they are a part of the one mind, that they are a miracle of life expressing in form. And they're in pain, and I can see what they're offering and interpret it as a request for help and healing rather than something for me to step back and judge as crappy and then create all of this negative tension in my body and my mind over it. And that's what they're saying here. The mind that is in perfect surrender looks out upon the world, and the world has been healed from the misperception that the mind intention and in judgment would project upon it. The mind in perfect surrender looks out upon the world that has been healed from its own misperception. And the misperception, the primary misperception, is that the world outside of me has any power over the essence of me, over the consciousness in me. That mind sees that at no time has it experienced anything but its own out-picturing. And this is why all events are neutral. It is mind, consciousness, that interprets an event, draws a conclusion, and then bases behavior upon it. And you are free to change that in each new present moment. You remain infinitely free to change the way you interpret and respond to every event in your life. And that is what creates your experience of life. The mind that is healed and rests in surrender looks out upon an innocent world that has been touched by its blessing of forgiveness. Its blessing, the mind's blessing of forgiveness. What's forgiveness? Dismantling every judgment and negative perception that I create about something. So when I do this enough, when I do this thoroughly, my mind looks out on a world that has been freed of all of the distortions and labels and perceptions that my mind has been placing on it. And remember from the introduction, that means I got to go back and start unpacking stuff that was programmed into me from age, you know, 2, 3, 4, from the beginnings of the origin of language being assimilated by me in this lifetime. There have been biases and prejudices and labels and arbitrary, artificial delineations of difference, this from that, up from down. Nudity is bad. Certain kinds of clothing are good. Certain other kinds of clothing are bad. This food is horrible. That food is desirable. People from this country are bad. People from that country are our allies. All of that stuff that's been programmed into me. I have to know the right answer. I'm going to get punished if I don't know the right answer. I'm only going to get rewarded or a pat on the back or a good grade if I know the exact right answer. The people who are teaching me have all the answers. All of these misperceptions have been programmed into me from the beginning of my being taught about language and about perception, my body versus somebody else's body. My body versus the chair and the desk, and I've been taught to perceive it all as different. But the mind that is healed will have gone in and dismantled all of those false perceptions and see a world that has been blessed by its process of dismantling false perceptions. So that mind will start to perceive the actuality of life far more clearly. That mind, which has moved closer and closer to the perfect level of dismantling false perceptions, will see what Yeshua was talking about in earlier lessons of the Way of Mastery, the shimmering radiance of the energy of creation extending through and as everyone and everything we interact with. The forgiveness process is simply a step in which that mind recognizes that the world it has thought was there was nothing more than its own mental creation. And that mind smiles and laughs and sees that the world that it created as illusion, as perception, holds no true power. And that all events have arisen and all interpretation of events have been generated from within the kingdom of that person's mind. the one place that is given unto you to assume full responsibility as your domain. You get to choose how you will interpret and respond to every moment of life and every event of flow, of the flow of creation. That can't be taken from you. As was pointed out in the Q&A in the Way of Mastery one time, your free will cannot be usurped. You can't be robbed of your ability to choose in each new present moment how you will interpret and respond to every event in your life. The text goes on and says, the mind that has been healed of illusion has been healed of all illusions. And while time and space seem to last, the last outpicturing of a tiny mad idea called the physical body can be given over to something else, can be transformed into a simple communication device that no longer communicates separation and judgment, but rather communicates forgiveness and innocence. It becomes nothing. It is picked up and used only when and in those ways that can speak, gesture, move, act, and make something in the world that touches the world with a blessing of the good, the holy, and the beautiful. And this is phenomenally antithetical to what the Western mind teaches us. The Western mind teaches us to be driven, to do more worksheets, to do more breath sessions, to heal the people around us, to eat better, to do this, to acquire more money, to get a better relationship, to get a different job, to do and do and do and do. And what this work is saying is that when the mind is appropriately or completely healed of its false perceptions, its illusions about the world, it doesn't do much of anything in the world unless the spirit of creation, pure love, the mind of the one creator, generates an impulse within it to do something, to say something that will extend the good, the holy, and the beautiful. And paradoxically, as is pointed out several times already in this work, rather than having me end up, you know, the further I go in the process of dismantling my judgments and my negativity and my upset and my labeling and my craving for this and that, the further I go in that process, the busier I get in a very different way, because I end up engaged in activities that are informed by this expansion of this loving energy that we call creation. And all of the impulses that I used to have to be seen as, you know, a great singer or a fabulous psychologist or a spiritual teacher or as a really benevolent giver of money and whatever, or a really creative interviewer, or whatever it was, whatever that impulse was, it becomes nothing. And the body itself is not used for those old pursuits. But it gets picked up and used only in those ways that can speak, gesture, move, act, and make something in the world that touches the world with the blessing of the good, the holy, and the beautiful. The text goes on and says, because this is simply the truth, it must mean that where you perceive justification for anything less than peace, it must mean that you have already decided in the deeper part of your mind to maintain this root or core misperception. That is, you're still attempting to perceive yourself as having accomplished the impossible. You have separated yourself from the mind of God in your fantasy illusion, and you're going to stick to that perception. You're going to continue to dream the dream of separation. Whereas the mind that is surrendered to the flow of life and love and asking to be taught each moment and what's mine to do to bless myself and the rest of creation, that mind looks out upon all things and quietly says within itself, there has only been creation. I am created of that. The source of my being, the source of my reality, rests in surrender to that and that alone. I and my Creator are one. Of myself, I do nothing. And yet through me, creation can do all things. The text goes on and says, the mind that is surrendered yet walks in your world as long as the body lasts and is often completely unrecognized by others around it. For the others see a body and therefore they assume there's an individual and an ego and a separated being within it as that body. When the mind is surrendered, you could say that the body walks as an empty shell and is merely waiting to be informed by the love of the Creator, by the love of creation itself, by this creative energy infinitely expanding, which is what it always does. When the love of God does not inform you or ask you to move or take action, then you simply rest and do nothing. That is why the final stage of awakening is incomprehensible in the languages of your world, since your languages are based on the very thought of separation itself. This is why when we speak of peace, we speak of a peace which is beyond all understanding. And this is one of the topics that was in the support group last night. People were asking questions about language and the ancient Aramaic language and whether or not Yeshua is the one who created all of this wisdom, and or whether some of the wisdom in this work is created was created and is contained in the very letters of the ancient Aramaic language. And there's a gentleman by the name of Stan Tenen, T-E-N-E-N. And he's done a lot of work about the geometry and the mathematics of the ancient Hebrew letters, which are the same letters for the ancient Aramaic, as I understand it. And the three-dimensional models of these ancient letters and how they fit around the hand and how you can turn your hand in hand gestures and form every letter in the Hebrew alphabet, which means every letter in the Aramaic alphabet. And then this led to a discussion of, so what's really going on here? It's not words and language like we have. It's vibration, it's tone, it's alignment of energy. This is why so many of the ancient, truly ancient languages did a lot more toning and chanting, humming deep resonance within the head and chest to align energetic vibrations rather than create languages of separation. Here's a word for that object over there. Here's a word for my judgment of that person over there. Whereas the actuality of life is just the extension and expansion of energy fields within energy fields within energy fields. So the mind-boggling thing for the Western mind, which has been given so little exposure to it, to the body's essence as a resonant energy field, and has been given so much training about perceiving itself as a physical body, as separate from this and that, as having all these different qualities, is that the very language we use to try and interface with our experience of life is language based in separation, based exclusively on the physical, almost exclusively on the physical. This is one of the more fascinating parts of Ian Shell Lungholz's lecture, when he called it the condor flies to the eagle, the South American wisdom of the Mayan calendar coming north to Canada or Alaska. And he went up there and gave this three-hour lecture. And one of the things that struck me most about the lecture was he was talking about how the calendar that we use in the Western world is exclusively tied to the movement of the physical body of our planet around the physical body of the sun, and nothing else. But these other cultures, the Mayans and Aztecs and other cultures through history, had all kinds of other energies that they tracked and had calendars for and gave reverence to and learned to tune into and named themselves around these divine intentions and personal flows, all these different things, whether it was lunar energy or the solar energy or the psychic energy, the divine flow energy. And yet, in our Western world, all of that has been cut out and squashed down to almost no awareness, and everything about our lives is driven by the calendar, and the calendar is simply about the physical movement of our planet around our sun. It's just another way in which we are conditioned to think and speak with a language that talks almost exclusively of the physical. And that means separation. That means artificial, arbitrary delineations of this from that, good from bad, up from down, etc. So to back up and say, when the mind is surrendered, you could say that the body walks as an empty shell and is merely waiting to be informed by the love of creation, by this creative force moving through it, which in this book they talked about that in Lesson 4 and gave it the word desire, the flow of the creative energy that wants to express uniquely through you in each new present moment. That's desire. That's this fundamental energy of creation. And when the love of the Creator does not inform you or ask you to move or take action, then you simply rest and do nothing. When you have moved into the place of surrendering completely from the conscious, logical, and the egoic, and the individual drives and urges and obsessions and passions, when you've surrendered all of that and you ask to be shown how to be a blessing to yourself and others in each moment, there will be times when you rest and do nothing. The next line says, this is why the final state of awakening is incomprehensible in the languages of your world, since your languages are based on the very thought of separation itself. Any of you who've had any exposure to Sanskrit and chanting or toning, you'll get a sense of this. If you heard Dale Allen Hoffman, I think Friday of this week we'll replay the interview I did with Dale Allen Hoffman. He wrote the book Echoes of an Ancient Dream as a way to introduce people to toning and chanting. And it isn't so much a word that you're chanting or toning or a meaning that your mind can give to this word. That's not the point of chanting or toning. The point of chanting or toning is to feel the vibratory energy in your mind-body energy system as it shifts when you let these energies roll through you. And they're rolling through you without any conscious direction. So when you are taught to tone or chant, you aren't taught to think about what it means. You're taught to let the experience unfold in, through, as, and around you. So instead of saying a word like Abwun, which is the first word in what they call the Lord's Prayer, A-B-W-O-O-N, so to spell it phonetically, Abwun. Abba, Father, womb, birthing. Rather than thinking about Abba as Father and giving birth to creation flowing, rather than consciously trying to make sense of how did they come up with these letters and what does that mean? Does it mean the word Father and does that not mean Mother? And rather than getting stuck in the intellectual processing, when you're toning or chanting those words, you're encouraged to just let all of that go and take a nice full deep breath and just hold on to these tones as they resonate through you. Just notice the difference of your energy experience between resonating with a tone like that and thinking about what it might mean. This is why the languages of your world cannot comprehend the peace which is beyond all understanding, because it doesn't come from a logical thought process leading to a certain conclusion with this label about, oh, that's good and this is bad and that's right and this is wrong. The text goes on and says, for the peace that you can understand in the languages of your world is conditional peace. We'll have peace when they stop blowing people up. We'll have peace when they let the water flow down the river so we each get an equal share. We'll have peace when people don't discriminate on color of skin. We'll have peace when fill in the blank. But the peace that passes all understanding is outside the realm of language. It's about aligning yourself with the flow of life, with the flow of the Creator. It's about the ancient Aramaic word for prayer meant setting a trap for God, aligning yourself as an antenna to receive the flow of the creative energy. The text goes on and says, for the peace you can understand in the languages of your world is conditional peace. It's the kind you create when two warring nations' leaders sit down in suits and ties and forget the death count and the destroyed villages. And they sign some kind of a document with a pen. And then they put on this show, this front, and they smile for pictures. And then they assume, and they teach everybody else to assume, that now we've got peace. And then each of them goes back and secretly continues to build weapons of defense against the attack, which is sure to come from the person they still perceive as an enemy. Why are they an enemy? Because they're separate from me. Why are they separate from me? Because that's the picture I've created in my mind. That's the illusion and the hallucination that I'm arguing for. The text goes on and says, peace cannot be bargained for. It is not the result of compromise. Peace comes only when any mind surrenders unconditionally the dream of the dreamer itself, so that there's only the creation and creation's creation. We've shared with you before that that creation is one. No divisions, no separations. It is the Christ mind, and that is all. And that mind is not in the body. It is not a particular form, and it certainly does not belong to any personal entity. The Christ mind is consciousness. The text says here, I, Yeshua, was never the Christ, as though you are not. Like you, I was a temporary modification of eternal energy. I was an outpicturing of a thought, a mental thought held in mind, which learned to surrender the misperception of the dreamer and learned to become informed only by Christ mind. Only that mind was present, and yet it could not be touched through the body. That is why my crucifixion had no effect on me whatsoever. It merely sped up the process whereby the body was dissolved away as an idea. Breathing, softening, watching what happens as you hear concepts like words and phrases like this about, so what if the person that gave rise to this book really was the one individual that was once in form as Yeshua, as Jesus, that was crucified? What is that doing to your conscious logical mind? Just breathe and soften and allow the introduction of concepts, of questioning of concepts, of awareness that all language you've ever been introduced to has been divisive in nature. It's been based in illusion, the illusion of separation, and it's been there to reinforce the concept that you are separate from your brothers and sisters, and that some of your brothers and sisters are better than you and you're worse than them, and some of them are worse than you and you're better than them. And every bit of the language you've been introduced to, indoctrinated into, is language of illusion, is language of separation, is language of judgment, is language of pain and suffering. And the language that is not of those things, that is of healing and peace and the energy of creation, is the language of energy and vibration. And you can step into experiencing that by canceling everything you think you want. Your conscious logical mind put on the shelf for now. Your trifling treasures put away. And you can step into the breath. You can step into focusing on the breath and breathing and softening. You can step into toning or chanting. And you can step into an experience of yourself as an energy field within an energy field within an energy field that goes beyond words each new present heartbeat. So, with a breath or two to soften, we'll leave the reading there today, and we have a few minutes if somebody has a question or a comment that they would like to raise or add before we start the audio for the second hour today, which will be the third hour of the Aramaicisms, which is a lecture that was given 2 hours of lecture two nights in a row. In 2015, with Dale Allen Hoffman and Dr. Michael Rice, in conversation about some of the deeper concepts of the ancient Aramaic language and their teachings, And we'll do the third hour today, the fourth hour tomorrow, and on Friday we will replay the interview I did with Dale Allen Hoffman on this internet show, which was probably around the same time frame. So, again, gratitude for everyone who's joining us here today. I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. And here's the third hour of Aramaicisms for the second hour of today's show.
I was going to say, in Tuvehun, and I'm going to come back to that word there for poor, we've got ripe, which is tuv. The EY sound genders this word feminine. It's the same as the ta at the end of a lot of words. And what that means is something that is a latent, or you could say a potentiality becomes activated, is the best way you can put that in modern English. And then the hun at the end means all of you who. And you know, there's one thing that's intriguing in the Beatitudes that if you don't read Aramaic, you won't see it. You won't see it in Greek, you won't see it in English, is all but one of, well, actually, what? Eight Beatitudes, he says, tuve hun, which means all of you here. One of the Beatitudes, he says, tuve kun, which means that he looked at one person and said it directly to that person, intriguingly. And then there's another one that actually doesn't have tuve hun in the beginning of it. But I'm doing this in English so you'll see it. If you look at the back, grab my business card back on the CD table and flip it, although you won't be able to pick it out, but I can point it to you, I actually show a copy from the ancient Aramaic Kaboris manuscript that shows two little dots that basically show up right here between what in English is the M and the S. Now what's intriguing is the reason that this Aleph Beit, this Estrangella style of writing was written was because prior to that point they didn't use phonetic markings to record the teachings of Jesus, meaning no vowel sounds. And they had big problems with that. Because without vowel sounds, the word changes. Okay? Now, if you have M-S-K-N together, let me hear you pronounce that M-S-K-N as a word. Every single person in here said Miskin. Okay? Now, when you put those there, it changes it from Miskin to Maskin. Now, let's talk about that just for a second. This is just the first beatitude. Now, there's two sets of meanings. Actually, there's a couple different meanings that all really mean the same thing. Miskin. Now, we've got poor. Miskin, if you have it with that flat I sound, miskin means poor, as in lacking. When Yeshua would talk about give your stuff to the poor, he would say miskin. M-S-K-N in English. And that's what you say naturally without a phonetic marking. But when you add that into maskin, this is what that means, okay? Let's say you've got a wallet and you've got $6,000 in it, and you've just got here to America, and you have no job, and your country is in civil war, and your family was killed off, and here you are, everything you own is in this wallet. You don't even have a suitcase. And you're standing in New York City in the middle of the night in an alley, the same alley that you heard a crack a couple minutes ago, and all of a sudden a guy comes up behind you and someone grabs the $6,000 out, and you turn, and he's way too far. You can't catch him. He's already turned the corner. You don't even know where he is. Every single possession that I had is now gone. I'm what? I'm poor. But I want to give you what that means in Aramaic, rather than poor as in lacking. I've got a wallet, and I've got $6,000 in it, and I open it up, and I take that $6,000 out, and I put it in my pocket. The wallet is now what? Empty. Everybody breathing? Empty in spirit, which means not poor as in lacking, but empty as in open. That word empty, maskin, also means home or sanctuary. The word spirit in Aramaic is rucha. Spirit is a concept that the first century Aramaic mind would have had no clue what it meant. It's a Latin term. Spiritus is a Latin word that's gendered masculine, meaning that it's a physical thing. And we spend our lives trying to find spirit, yet again, in the words of St. Francis, what you are looking for is what is looking. Spirit and or breath in Aramaic, rucha, is feminine. Not poor in spirit, but empty and open, and home in breath, spirit, energy, magnetism, cosmic expansion, the eternal forces of the One. Now going even deeper in this, being feminine, it means this as well. In what do I feel on my arm right now? That's what? Breath, right? In John 3, Nicodemus and Yeshua are having a conversation, and Yeshua says, you must be reborn of water and spirit, is what we're told in the King James. Now, intriguingly, in Aramaic, what he says is maya and rucha. Maya, water, literally does not mean simply water. It means the great flowing expanse. It's at the end of Shemaya, which is the word heaven, which is also the word sky. And rucha, he wouldn't have said breath and spirit. He probably would have gone breath or water and spirit. He would have said water, maya, and because in the first century, spirit and breath were not two separate things. Spirit didn't exist in their mind because what we now think of as spirit as separate from breath at that time was simply rucha, which is breath. Now let me say one more thing. In the first century Aramaic mind, what you feel on your arm, that's spiritus. That's a masculine physical thing that we now call breath. Is everybody breathing? In Aramaic, it wasn't what I felt on my arm that was breath. That's hot air. In the first century Aramaic mind, breath was not the hot air that moved through my lungs. It was my feminine perception of its movement. It wasn't a thing. It was the experience of this. That's what rucha is. And when you're empty in the expansion and the contraction of breath, spirit, energy, insight, growth, whatever it may be, that's what it meant. It didn't mean hot air on your arm. Is everybody clear? That's why we're out there looking for spirit. And as an example, I asked the question, will science ever find God? People are like, oh yeah, the superstring theories and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, that's interesting. Because quantum theory says that as you observe, you create. Which means that whatever they're finding is them. And what they're not realizing is they're looking for what's looking. What they are looking for is what is looking. God is not thing, God, and that's a concept in Aramaic that it doesn't exist in Christianity. Allah, the word for God in Aramaic, means absolute only being. Interesting. You've got the ah sound, which is Allah, which means everything, lamed, which means movement, and ha, which means breath. The One lives and breathes within itself. Allah. And that's you. Is everybody breathing? If you ever feel like you're not getting something, let go of trying to understand it and just keep your breath moving. And what needs to happen will happen.
If you look at that Pentecostal experience where all kinds of awesome things happen and the tongues of fire upon their heads, the Greeks tell us that Yeshua breathed on them. It's not what it says. It says He breathed them. He showed them how to stay connected to that one holy breath. And you'll watch people in trauma, and the first thing that they do is cut themselves off from that whole breath. And when they cut themselves off, they literally cut themselves off from the eternal forces. Now they're locked within their own parameters. That is, what is their life experience and what's in their genes. You look at that story about the sins of the fathers are passed into 3 and 4 generations. What are they talking about? They're talking about the energy patterns. And when we're locked in, you know, the sins of the father are passed down to 3 and 4 generations. Anybody remember the second half of that passage? It says, yea, of those who hate me. It's not hate in terms of a love-hate relationship. It's those who are separated from the active presence of love in which we live, move, and have our being. And the way you separate yourself from it is by holding your breath. How many people remember them telling stories about you when you were 2 and you'd hold your breath until you turned blue and passed out? I've run into hundreds of people that's been their experience. And they spend most of their lives cut off from that flow that's designed to come through them. And they live in this intellect, in this 9-bit mind. Don't disturb my state of belief because I already know. If you're in pain, you don't know.
You would have a much more accurate understanding of first century Aramaic teachings, if you were to take the Jesus teachings and just pencil out the word spirit and write the word breath above it. If you do that, just try it with one of those green Bibles, the Gideon Bibles you get, you know, either on the urinals or in the drawer of the hotel room, and cross out spirit and write breath above it. Now, this is that phrase from, is it John 20:22? Jesus breathed on them. This is great theology because Jesus has all the power, just like Horus and all the ancient Egyptian guys and Dionysus and Osiris and Mithra. Napak lahun. If it said this, I'm doing this in English so you'll see it a little more clearly. This lamed, which is this, I told you it means movement. It means on, toward, or at. Now this is something that in modern Aramaic scholarship, a lot of them don't even know that these two, somewhere around 1700 years ago, became interchangeable, the lamed and the bet, in terms of a prefix. This means on, toward, or at, the la sound. So if it was napak lahun, it would be he breathed on them, or at them, or toward them. But what it actually says in Aramaic is napak bahun. Now, bah means with, within, or through. Not he breathed at them, on them, or toward them, but he breathed with them. He breathed them through. That's a whole different thing. Not him having power that he breathes on them, but what happens, this is after the resurrection and he's standing in front of them, if that actually happened. I'm pretty sure that if a guy that I knew all of a sudden and I saw hanging on a cross and I saw his dead body and all of a sudden he's standing in front of me, I'd probably stop breathing. I don't know if I would today, but you know, I would say the average person would probably catch at least a little bit. If there's like I said about Minnie Pearl earlier, if Minnie Pearl walked in the back door, I probably would do a little bit of a, you know. Are you getting what I'm saying here? This is about...
What's your relationship with Minnie Pearl here?
I love Minnie Pearl. We are in the South, aren't we? You see the difference here? Now, here's the problems here is, the one problem we've got is that in modern Semitic scholarship, it's not even acknowledged that these two had separate meanings, with, within, or through versus on, toward, or at. So if a modern, many Aramaic or Semitic-based scholars translate, they don't know the actual first century difference between the two, and they become interchangeable, and all of a sudden the message changes entirely, just because of a single letter.
Has anybody here ever been with someone the last 48 hours of their life when they were experiencing a non-crisis death? Anybody ever been with somebody? What did they do in the last 24 to 48 hours? They started to breathe like this. They connected in a whole breath, and then they'd hit a place called a still point, where they'd stop breathing altogether for a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, until their lips start to turn blue. And then they'd go back, and they'd do that breath. I think that the person who's getting ready to leave their bodies intuitively knows they need to reconnect in order to process out the garbage that they're carrying with them and not have to take it with them. We're looking at clarifying the original Aramaic terms in the teachings of the man named Yeshua in particular, although not exclusively, in order to understand a thought system and a healing system that is disappearing from the planet. And we're looking to restore that first century thought system that has just had such longevity, even in distorted forms, that when we get back to the original, it just opens a whole different game. So we're delighted that you're here. And Dale Allen Hoffman is a local Aramaic scholar, probably the most practical scholar on the planet that I know of anyway. And he's going to open with the Lord's Prayer. And
to set the tone. Yeah. We did this. Anybody here last night? I'm going to come down here. What we're going to do is we're going to tone a sound together, which is the first word of the Lord's Prayer in a Far Eastern dialect. If you're in the West, it sounds more like Abvun or Abvunach, depending on where you are. If you go further into the East, it starts sounding more like Avun or Aun. We're going to do the Aun sound. Say that once, Aun.
Aun.
It's kind of like Om, but there's an N at the end. Say that one more time.
Aun.
Now I'm going to tone this sound one time, so you know what I mean by toning, without talking about toning a lot. Toning is essentially, just as a quick description, you're basically taking a sound that's normally sacred, really it could be any sound, it doesn't even have to be a word, and you're elongating the vowel sounds and allowing it to come through as deeply as you can in the present moment. It's not singing or performance, it's different. This isn't about having a great quality voice, it's just about having an open quality heart and presence in the moment, and the sound will take care of itself. So I'll tone one time, and then we're going to do this together three times, and then I'm going to go into the prayer, okay? And I'm just going to go into the prayer in Aramaic tonight rather than also English, okay? And you'll understand after this, you'll feel it. You'll feel why I did this to begin, okay? So just listen to this first tone. Remember the N, which is the letter nun, at the end of the word, because all you're going to be doing from that ooh is just taking the tip of your tongue and resting it on the back of your upper teeth. Remember that sound. Don't forget that one, okay? So let's do Aun three times. This last one ring out, okay? Wide open, far beyond the expanse of this beautiful building. Last one. Now just be aware of your breath and be open. Avund Voshmaya Nit Kadash Shmah Tete Malku Tah Nehwe Tivyanak Aikana Voshmaya Ap Bearea Hablan Lachmadasun Kanan Yomana Washwoklan Hobain Wachtahain Aikana Daphanan Shwakan Lachayavain Huela Tahlan Lenesiune Elapetsan Minbisha Metul Didelaki Malkuthach Wahel Wateshbukta La Alam Amen. Amen. From this rooted earth may all my actions flow. And so it is.
Sweet. Thank you. One of the most basic teaching of so much of the Western world is that there's something for you to fear. And it's the ever-present Almighty that if you do some sort of an offense, then you're going to be punished for eternity. And so we hear an interpretation in the Greek translations, and if you look at the Greek gods were all about control and fear, and, you know, I mean, the atrocities they committed are amazing, and that's been transferred into the Aramaic meanings, and we're told to fear love. The Creator is love. And if you look at how bizarre a concept that is, you look back into the Old Testament, it says, fear is a commandment of men. Men made that whole game up. And you've got to start to question. You've got to come out of insane belief systems in order to truly function as a full human being. And the word that is in place of that fear is really to have awe. And there's some interesting research that's come out of Stanford recently where they're researching the impact of awe on people. And what they're finding is that when people go into awe, when they can't process with their minds the way they normally do, and they are awestruck, that it transforms everything in them. It literally transforms their psychological state. It transforms the state of their health. It transforms everything. And so what is this state of awe? What do you want to, how do you move into that state of awe? And what's it really all about? Is it about doing the right thing for the wrong reason because we've been told if we don't do it, we're going to be punished? No, that's a thing called propitiation. T.S. Eliot gives us a really easy way to understand that word, which is not very popular in our culture. And he's got a poem where he says, 'Tis the highest treason to do the right thing for the wrong reason. And you look at people who've been trained through fear, and they continuously work to do the right thing, not realizing that every time they work to do the right thing, they in fact are resonating a disease within their own cellular structures by doing the right thing. Trained through fear, fear being in the cell, fear being a disease to the cell, one acts through fear and ends up destroying themselves, wondering where all these horrible diseases come from when the root of the disease process is in the training of fear. And so Dale's going to talk about the I am and what that really means and how awesome it is when you understand it from the Aramaic.
One thing that I think a lot of people have heard is Moses in that burning bush and the I am that I am, which could be translated from Hebrew as I shall be that I shall be, I am becoming that I am becoming, I am flowering that I am flowering, I am fractally expanding that I am fractally expanding. Yeshua used a different word when he was talking about I am. One of the questions I get asked the most in the last 20 years is, all right, hold on a second, I get everything else you're saying, but there's one hook I still have. Usually it's John 3:16 is one. We might get to that one a little later, but the thing I get asked the most is, what about when he says, I am the bread of life, or I am the way and the truth and the life, or I am the gate, I am the good shepherd, all these different places. All of those actually in the Gospel of Yohanan, John, incidentally. I put these up here on the board before we began, just thinking as an experiment, maybe it would burn its way through the board or something. It didn't. This is something that's so easy and clear to understand, and it's literally not possible to understand except from the Aramaic perspective. It's not that it couldn't be said in another language, but something I talked of yesterday is there's a big danger in translation without experience. And when I say experience, I don't mean past experience. I don't mean having 30 years behind you with translation. I mean open experience now in the moment. Without Gilyana, the revelation, the unveiling, there's no chance of you really bringing something through, because it's only going to come through in the perspective of what your mind can hold or handle or comprehend. And any translation is going to be a dumbing down. It's just the way it goes. This is something that's so easy to understand. Right here, it's got three letters, Aleph, Nun, Aleph. Sounds like this, Anna, Anna. So if anybody knows the name Anna, someone with the name Anna, this is what Anna means, I. Okay? I. It could also mean I am, but it's a very specific, it only has one meaning, which is either I as in I Dale or I Dale am. If I'm going to walk across the room, I would say Anna. Technically, let me put it this way, in Aramaic, it tends to most often be pronounced, even though you can see that it's the same ah. You can see that it looks like Anna. It tends to be pronounced as Ana or Ina, okay, or even Inna. I'm going to show you why. Well, I don't know exactly how the connection happened, but I'm going to show you why that is in a few minutes, okay? It's something that's going to be more important after you see what I'm going to unpack here. Now, Ana, Ina, Anna, this sound, if I, Dale, was going to do something, like I say, I would say Anna, going to walk across the room. You got that? Very clear. If Yeshua was saying, as an example, Ananuha Deyoma, I, Jesus, am the light of the world. Nuhra de Alma, the light of the world, or the light of creation. There's so many ways you can translate Alma. He would say, Ina, Nuhra de Alma, I, Jesus, am the light of the world. But what's really intriguing is that in Aramaic, what's written on the page is actually this two times, not once. Now, you're about to learn a lesson in translation. If one Ina means I, what would two Inas mean? Us, we. Anything else? Who said it? I. Anything other than I would change its meaning. It's adding something that's not on the page. Do you understand what I'm saying? If you were to put two I's next to each other and say we, in truth, what you're doing is changing what is written on the page. What would be literal is I. Okay? Now, there's a quote that I gave a couple of times last night from St. Francis. Take a breath. St. Francis of Assisi said, what you are looking for is what is looking. Not everybody's going to pick that up. If you're trying to understand it, you have 0% chance of understanding it. If you take a breath and let go, it's your only chance of getting that one. If you felt like even you don't quite get what I just said, then you got it, okay? So, I inside of the I within the I, not the physical I, something behind the physical eyeball, but as an example, when you look in the mirror, that which is observing that reflection in the mirror is understanding that that's simply a reflection. The reflection is not what's real, nor is what it's reflecting. The only thing that is real is the observation or the awareness itself. Okay? I need you to breathe. Now, intriguingly, when you look at it like this, the eye within the eye, a good example of what eye within the eye is, we talked a lot about babies and holding a baby in the first 20 minutes of life. That's inanna, I. Now that I say inanna, even though it looks like ana on the page, the way we pronounce this is, in Aramaic, inanna. One of them is masculine. Masculine meaning it's me, physical person. When you've got two together, it's a feminine phrase, which means not a person or a thing, but rather a state of being and experience. Incidentally, Inanna is the ancient Sumerian goddess of love, fertility, and warfare. Inanna is what most of the Christian teachings are actually based on, the ancient Sumerian goddess. Most of the earliest Christian teachings are about goddess energy. They're about feminine energy. They're not about masculine things. Misogynists change those over time. Misogynist means literally woman haters, okay? Now, if you've ever listened to Bob Marley, you know, oh pirates, yes they rob I, sold I to the merchant ship. Minutes after they took I, one of the ways you can understand that is I, and in Aramaic I'm going in this direction, okay? It's the I within the I. Pirates, yes, they rob I. I am projected into this world, though I am not of it. You getting what I'm saying? It's about the awareness behind who you think you are. It's about consciousness itself. That's the bread of life. That's the resurrection and the life. That's the light of the world. And what sees through me is what sees through you. If you were to actually imply that a man was any of those things that Christianity has done today, you committed a blasphemy, you turned his teachings 180 degrees exactly opposite, and you killed the message. Imagine this. Imagine that we've got one singular body of God, and let's just, you know, when we think cosmos or universe or multiverse, I'm talking everything, whether it's manifest or non-manifest. Does it make a lot of sense, even looking at it this way would be even better, does it make a lot of sense with one singular light that manifests itself in billions of human bodies, would it make any sense whatsoever to point at one of those lights and say that one of those lights is better than the others? One of those is only begotten. One of those is the bread of life. Is there any sense in that whatsoever? It's not the light on the board that's the light of the world. It's light itself. Do you feel that? Do you sense it? If you're trying to understand this, you have 0% chance. If you, as I said in the beginning, if you take a breath, keep your breath moving and allow your heart to be open and you feel that movement of the Spirit, then you've got it. Everybody's had those moments in meditation, music, holding a baby in your arms where everything just works out just right and you're in that divine balance and it's almost as if you're the witness or you're observing your human life. That's what he was talking about. Interesting. It changes all of those completely, totally and completely. That's the light of the world. And we could spend 5 hours going through all of those phrases. So,
well, it's interesting that the only thing that changed was the pronoun when he said to those before him, you are the light of the world. If you choose to step into that being within, you know, and it ties in with the idea of, which to the average person doesn't make any sense, in order for you to live, you've got to die. Well, when we get lost, as we talked about yesterday, in this carbon-based memory system, we literally build information into the mind based on messages that come from the world of hostility or fear, and those messages that come from the world of hostility or fear tend to drag us out of the state of being. Hold the newborn child. You've got the active presence of love. You have this state of being that we all started as. And when we started there, the world did its best to drag us into those messages. And these messages, based on a world of hostility and fear, solidified or coagulated into a picture in the mind that most people call I. They fell from grace, and they became identified with this. The moment of the deepest pain and the deepest rage that anyone will ever experience, and a moment that has to be worked back through. So when Yeshua is saying, in order for you, being, to live, you, non-being, have to die. This self has to go. And this is the I behind what we call I. And that tends to get lost.
Is there anybody that doesn't get it right now? I haven't asked many questions the last couple nights. It's okay if you raise your hand. Here's the thing. If you were trying to grok it and understand it, and you have no clue what I just said, it's because it's the reflection that's trying to understand. It's your human eye that's trying to understand. And the whole point of the entire passage, of those passages, is that it doesn't happen here. It's where it's projecting from. You know, Michael's got a great analogy that he uses a lot of times where, let's just as an example, say you're in some sort of a projection booth, movie theater, and you take some guy out of the jungle, and you've got an apple sitting on a table, and it's projecting on a screen, and you take this guy from the jungle into this room, he's never seen a projector before, he's never seen a movie, and he sees that apple there, and you tell him, move the apple from this side to that side. Where's he going to go to move the apple? He's going to go into the world. He's going to go to the screen, the projection. And yet, Yeshua walks back in the projection booth, or the projectionist walks back into the projection booth, moves the apple, comes back out from that space within, and all of a sudden the apple's moved, and everybody goes, oh my God, holy Messiah, you've created miracles. When all he did was work within the system. It's one thing about, imagine this, let me put it, this is from Yogananda, he says, well, let me preface it with James Allen. James Allen says, what then is the meaning of fighting against circumstances? It is when one is continually revolting against an effect without, while all the while he is nourishing its cause in his heart. And another one from Yogananda says, when man transfers his sense of identity from his pseudo-soul or ego or mask or persona back to the true light of his being, he will realize that all pain is unreal. Suffering ceases to exist for one who is pure. And when we learn to view the scenes of the divine play of what we call the world, what Yeshua called the cosmos, he said, I come to destroy the world. You know what the word world is in Greek? Cosmos. I come to destroy the cosmos. Did he speak Greek? No. You know what that word is in Aramaic? Alma. Remember, I am the light of the world. I'm the light of the cosmos. Interesting. And I came to destroy that. And Yogananda said, to be able to view this Leela or divine play, the Maya, that world of liquid illusion, as the ever joyous witness of a stupendous cosmic drama. And that's that. It's taking your identity away from the echoes of your hidden past and coming back to the light of your being. How do you do that? You practice forgiveness, removing the root of your suffering.
And one of the number one pseudo solutions of what we'll call the non-being mind, this is a state of non-being. It's a total fabrication. And as Dale said, if you're trying to understand from that, that non-being self can't understand everything, though it pretends life. It pretends existence. And all it is a projection from a set of brain cells based in hostility, fear, and pain. That's why most relationships based in that end up in divorce. Because one who's not willing to be responsible for their hostility, their fear, or their pain ceases to be the light in their own lives and certainly ceases to be a light in that relationship. When two people really connect in true relationship, each of them begins to bypass this self that isn't, the self that can't understand anything, and be the light for each other, and in so doing forms literally a new energy, a new creation as such that was called the Pagra. The joining of two in that light forms a third entity. And so that third entity doesn't come from this state of non-being. And one of the number one pseudo-solutions, in one of our workshops we go through what I call the pseudo-solutions of the non-being mind. And the number one pseudo-solution is, if I could just figure this out. Now, if we took everybody in the room and wrote down your age and added it all up and subtracted 5 years for every person in the room, we'd have the number of years that people in this room have been trying to figure it out. And if you notice, you can't figure it out. But here's what you can do and why Dale says forgive is the key. Because each time that you forgive, you literally remove, substitute, when you think actual forgiveness, substitute the word remove for forgive, and forgiveness means I remove this rage, I remove this fear, I remove this sadness, I remove this pain, I forgive this rage, this guilt. And think about what it's like to come into the world. You know, we asked the question last night, how many have held a newborn child? Describe the newborn, and everybody's descriptor is some variation on the theme of love. Why? Because everybody knows what human life is. When human life fuels your cellular structure, your physiology is in ecstasy, is in that state continuously. Think about what it would be like for a child 2, 3, 4, 6, 10 months, 12 months, 15 months of age, to all of a sudden have received so many messages from the world that they are something other than the presence of love. Anybody ever get a message from your power person that you were something other than love? We had a woman, we asked this question, we're not going to do a dialogue or interaction on it, but we asked a woman a couple of years, or a group a couple of years ago, and this woman came forward, and she shared that when she was 6 years of age, her father came to her and told her that until she was born into the family, they had the perfect family. And when she was born into the family, she destroyed the family. Now think about what that kind of a message, when the child doesn't know how to refuse it, buys that message and forms a self out of it, that the mind actually takes all of those messages. And one of the things the human mind does is it converts information into pictures. It goes from digital to analog. So once we accept a certain amount of incorrect information about ourselves, then the mind starts to generate this picture of who we think we are. Imagine the pain that would be experienced by someone who started out at conception, has been fueled by love up until the age of 12, 14, 16 months, whatever, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, and all of a sudden, that is ecstasy is ripped away from them. And this true self goes blotto, and this self takes over. You have some reason why we have, or you get some insight when you realize that's what virtually all of us have gone through. You get some insight as to why the world is so insane, why there is such hatred and rage and murder, because the pain of that moment is beyond comprehension. And it is a pain that each of us has to work our way back through, and the way that you work back through it, the key tool, and without this tool, whatever you're engaging in, whatever you're studying, you know, there are lots of interesting things in the world, but if it isn't showing you how to remove the lies that were planted into your mind, the lies that were resonated out of your genetics by those lies, if it isn't showing you how to forgive those things, to remove them, and ultimately collapse this non-being self so that the non-being self dies and the true self comes into existence, then that teaching, whatever it is like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. Who cares? The ship's going down. You know, you may be a little closer to the band, and so you hear the music better. You may get to the far end of the ship, so you're the last one whose toes hit the icy cold water, but the ship's on its way down. Whatever you engage in understanding how to remove the root of all hostility and fear so that the self that is not dies. And the true being that you are once again incarnates or comes back to habit this form and become the light of the world, become the light in relationship. If we're in relationship and Dale gives me the look and up comes my terror and I don't know how to hold love present for that, I don't know how to heal that, then I can turn to this person I have a power with and say, I need support, and Dale can become the light that supports my healing, and vice versa. So when we become that for each other in relationship, rather than, you know, if I'm in pain and I resonate Dale's pain, so Dale gets lost in his and I get lost in mine, and now we've got a schmozzle, we've got a mess.
The official word, schmozzle.
Schmozzle, yeah, it's an official. Yeah, it's a mayor make word.
Maybe, it could be. It sounds like it, actually.
So when we can be that light for each other, the eye within the eye, then something different happens. And it transforms everything. And it moves into that state of a state that's so far beyond comprehension of this carbon-based memory system that we talked about yesterday, a state that's just so far beyond it that it's not even conceivable. And what happens when that I comes present, whether it's presenced by someone else or whether you're able to bring your own I present, then that state of awe is created and that energy begins to transform everything within you that is not like itself. That's what I understand Stanford is talking about when they're talking about how transformative that state of awe is. When your brain can't process it the way it normally does, it opens. And what opens in the presence of awe heals. And it heals instantly. And that's what, if you go back to Yeshua, again, 2,000 years ago, I come to bring you life, and more abundantly. There is no life in the body of its own unless it is plugged into the power supply it's designed for. My take is that the average person, as a human being, as love, is dead by the age of 4. Think about when the stress is up and the chips are down, the child, how many know of a child at 4 or 5 or 6 or 10 or 12 or 20 or 50 or 70 or 90 that stays present as love to the experience that is stressful for them? If you can't do that, then those stressful experiences bring up that non-being self that obliterates human life. Yeshua says, I come to bring you life. He didn't come to bring you fear about what God's going to do to you. I come to bring you life and bring it more abundantly and to show you how to incarnate that life by removing everything that doesn't belong. You must forgive from your heart, that is your own unconscious, that which you put into your brain's image of yourself and that which you put into your brain's image of your brother. And you think you feel what your brother did to you, but what you really feel is what's going on inside of you, resonated by your brother. And when your brother comes and gives you the gift of rage, of hostility, of fear, and that resonates, rage or hostility or fear in you, they've given you the gift to recognize that if that's the energy that's moving in you, then you'll paint pictures on the inside of your eyeballs based in rage and fear. And when you do, you give up your human life. And you spray the energy of that hostility and fear on everybody that you look at. When you begin to remove those things, then that darkness is replaced by the truth of your being, of light. And when that happens, everything that you paint on the inside of your eyeballs, every construct that your mind makes is based in love and therefore sprays light on the world and transforms everything that happens. If we can get enough people through the gate of understanding and doing that work, and that's the challenge. Doing the work, right?
What?
Yes. Me? I have to change something?
You know, there's a couple of things you said that were so rich that, intriguingly, the word awe is interesting because we've got that word awful today. You know what's funny? We know what awful means today. If you go back and you look at literature from the turn of the 19th into the 20th century, awful wasn't a bad thing. And then full of awe. We've got terrific. That's terrific. You know, when Perry Como said the traffic is terrific in Home for the Holidays, I don't think he meant that he loved all the traffic, you know, around the Christmas holiday. We messed the words up. Yeah, and, you know, I mentioned briefly about Bob Marley earlier and the I. You know, it's intriguing to me that Rastafarianism has preserved many of the ancient Aramaic teachings of Yeshua better than Christianity has. One of the reasons for that is because Amharic, Ge'ez, and the Ethiopic languages come directly from Aramaic. Directly. Interesting. And, you know, the other profound thing that got me thinking was and I'm sure he'll probably come back to it, he went and talked about something about digital versus analog. Now, my business for 18 years before I was doing this full time was compact disc and CD and Blu-ray replication packaging, from polycarbonate to finished product. Interesting. And, you know, if you look at the surface of a CD, there's these things called pits and lands. It almost looks like the top of a castle. And these little pits here and these lands actually are basically little recorders or samples of information. Now, analog means this. Analog, cassette tape, vinyl, albums. This is a pure sine wave, something that's completely unbroken, something that's eternally that's always connected. There's no break in it. The funny thing about digital, much like a CD, is that it samples of information. And it's only going to pick up little samples of this. As an example, let's look at this. This is 128K MP3. This here would be a 256K MP3. It's got more information. This here is a 320K MP3. Every time you go higher with more samples, you're picking up more information. You want to go backward from an MP3, you get down around 96 samples per second, it starts sounding a little bit like this. You get far enough down, you got Morse code. How much information can you jam into Morse code? Can you shove Stairway to Heaven into Morse code? Or like anything from Glenn Miller? Is that going to happen? It can't hold the information. Your brain can't hold everything. It can only give you a little teeny tiny bit of it. And we're living... This is that divine play. This is the 666. This is the Antichrist, that which keeps you from being an open channel in the world. And somehow we go through trying to understand and grok, and we believe what this thing is telling us, but this thing is only giving us little teeny tiny samples of the actual experience. This right here, that's who you are. You are that light. You're not you're not what's projected on the board. You are where it's coming from. And that's not something your brain can even handle or grok. It's what allows your brain to function, but this doesn't work in reverse. We've spent so much time looking at the movie screen thinking that that's who we were, and what Michael's doing here is he's showing us how to change the film strip and the projector. And the other aspect of that is occasionally just pull the film strip out. Just allow yourself to be open. Just be light itself. You getting what I'm saying? How do you do that? By breathing and forgiving and allowing yourself to be open. Stop believing your brain.
So it occurs to me there then, so this is not whole and this is holy. It's whole. It's connected. And when we live in this picture in our minds, I talked yesterday for those that weren't here about the Harvard research. It says in a time frame where 10,000 brain cells fire, the max amount of information you can perceive is 9 bits. Sampling, little pieces. And we believe what our brain shows us is true about something outside of us, when it is never true about something outside of us, because what our brain constructs its pictures from is samplings of data within, 9 bits out of 10,000. And when you can collapse that, and basically what first century Aramaic forgiveness does is it collapses those pictures that come from this carbon-based memory system that are painted on the inside of our eyeballs and radiate out energy waves that are like what we're painting with. If you paint a picture of somebody on the inside of your eyeballs out of your own hostility or fear, then you are spraying hostility or fear on them. The acid of hostility or fear is not anything that anybody enjoys having sprayed on them. When you change that and you replace it with the first law of Rachma, maintaining a condition of love in your mind, the gateway for love, then the pictures you paint on the inside of your eyeballs are sourced from another place. And that other place means that everything you look at is being sprayed literally with the high energy wave of the active presence of love. That transforms everything in your physiology and in your world.
You know, Michael mentioned that word holy. It's the Greek word holos, which means whole. The word in Aramaic and Hebrew is kadosh, kudshah, kadosh. What that means is not holy as in better than secular. It means all-encompassing, all-embracing, whole. You know, one of those phrases that we were given was, as an example, be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. It's an interesting thing. Be perfect. Anybody ever tried to build or construct the perfect life? All the seminars you went to, workshops. We live in Asheville. We're on overload on that whole thing here, okay? And there's no shortage. There's probably 500 other healing whatever things going on tonight, Tuesday night here in Asheville, North Carolina. But here's an interesting thing about that word, be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. That word is gemira. And what gemira means is whole, all-encompassing, all-embracing. Another place is in 1 Timothy in the writings of, this is Paul, where he says, perfect love casts out all fear. Perfect love casts out all fear. Now, intriguingly, that word in Aramaic for perfect, let's remember, this is Saul of Tarsus. This is a native Aramaic speaker. The letters that he did not write in Aramaic, except for some Greek letters that he wrote, were generally written by another scribe that he would dictate them to, because he didn't speak all these languages. This is a traveling dude. Even in today's world, the traveling that he did is pretty freaking impressive if you actually see a map of the places Paul has been. Now, that word for perfect love casts out fear sounds like this. Mashalamya. Mashalamya. What's in the middle of it? Shalom. What's that? Shalom. Peace. Now, we've got this weird idea of peace here in the West. We seem to think that as cessation of conflict is what peace means, but actually in Semitic languages, Aramaic, Hebrew, and all the others before it, what peace means, shalom, shlama, means the embracing of the fullness of potential. Not that there isn't conflict, but everything is seen holistically and holy, wholly. We've had this sort of ideal where we think that we have to live up to some kind of perfection in the world, and that's the whole problem. We're trying to make something perfect that's not even real. We're trying to shift details out here that aren't even real details, because all we're going to get is whatever it is that the film strip that's in our projector is going to allow. You getting what we're saying here? Now, let me say this. That word mashalamya, or mashalam, is an interesting word because we were told that Judas betrayed Jesus, right? Intriguingly, exactly like the story of Typhon betraying Horus. That's a different thing, but maybe, maybe not. Intriguingly, though, there was this Gospel of Judas that popped up a few years ago in Greek, and Marvin Meyer, amazing, probably one of the most well-versed, if not the most well-versed, biblical scholar on the planet, was hired by National Geographic to head up this league of scholars that translate it. And everybody made this big deal out of it because in Greek it said paradidom, or paradidomi, instead of betray. What does paradidomi mean? It means this: to fulfill, to make whole, to complete, to fulfill something that is asked of you. And everybody made this big deal. Wait a second, he didn't betray him. He just did what was asked of him. And what's even more intriguing is if you go back into almost all of the Greek scriptures referencing Judas betraying Jesus, almost every single one says paradidomi. And I'm like, why is everybody making a big deal out about it in the Gospel of Judas when it was there the whole time right under their noses? Now let's think about this for a second. I know it makes great art to have a guy betraying another guy. But let's look at this really, okay? If you actually look in the Jesus teachings, especially in Aramaic, and you start pulling in some of the ancillary gospels that weren't allowed in the Bible, anybody want to guess who were the two closest companions of Yeshua? According to what we do know? Judas and Mary Magdalene. If anybody wants to think Peter, Peter was the human ego. Peter was that. Peter was the head of the church. Peter was the thinker. He couldn't understand anything that Jesus was saying. It's funny because I can imagine Yeshua knocking on their foreheads occasionally, like, you know, Biff talking to George McFly in Back to the Future, like, anybody in there? You know, knocking, like, if you guys don't get it, my frontline disciples, how are they going to get it? Intriguingly, when it says that he turned him over, it says mashalamya. Now, let me ask you something. If someone was going to turn you over and you knew you were going to be crucified and hung on a stick, and you knew you were going to be tortured and maimed, who would you want to do that? For me, it would be my family. I would want to see my family to the absolute last microsecond that that door closed. How did he turn them over? With a kiss. Interesting. And then what did he do after that? What did Judas do? He hung himself. Does that sound like something that a vindictive dude's going to do? You know what's interesting? If you go back in Egyptian mythology, Typhon hung himself. I know it makes great art, but the funny thing is we've lived with this idea of a betrayal here, and we've got all this hate that we love to spew toward Judas, when all that is a yet another insane not even reason, but excuse for us to be able to feel the hate and to feel the hatred and the fear and all of that. It's just, and oh, because it happened in the Bible, so we can feel it.
And blame it on somebody else.
Oh, yeah. You can find anything you want in the Bible. If you want, you know, let's just say it's all in there. You know, if you're looking for whatever, I'm just going to stay clean on this. Read the Old Testament especially. If you want to find some wild stuff, read it, okay? Stop acting like you did and being an expert. Actually read it, and you'll find some crazy things, and that's all I'm going to say on that, okay?
Well, tie in with that idea that Vladimir Lenin put forward, and that is when you can change the meaning of a culture's words, you can destroy the culture. And you look at that word betrayal. Betrayal is a political. Traitor is a political word. It takes Yeshua out of this, the teacher of how to connect with whole field perception, how to live out of the state of being and be in communication with the Creator on all levels, and it puts them squarely into a political game, which is where they want them, because then they can make anything of them they wish.
Which is probably what everybody thought of him anyway. They probably thought he was some kind of a physical Mashiach coming back to save the world. And they're constantly asking, when do we draw our weapons? You know, when do we go and start killing people and beheading? What did he say? I'm not here for that. But
well,
yet, so, look at Christianity today.
Yeah, well,
it sure looks
so,
like it's here for that.
It's so powerful when you hear him after Peter waxed off the high priest's servant's ear, and Yeshua says, Peter, the reason I allowed you to bring a sword was to teach you a lesson. If you live by the sword, you will die by the sword. How different would our world be today if we could just hear that single message? Now, it doesn't matter if the sword is your tongue with rage. If you wound with that, then the one you wound is yourself. You will die from that wound that you inflict on yourself.